Right now, I wanted to give him a forearm smash to the face, burst his fat nose all over the place. I closed my eyes. Wild Child Butler and I promised ourselves it would happen. Further on up the road. I opened my eyes and switched off the music in my head. Standing in front of me on the other side of the bars was the fingerprint officer. She was on her way back from the coffee hot plate.
"Can I get you a cup of coffee?"
she asked me. "Sure," I said. "Great. No cream, no sugar." She put her own cup down on the nearest desk and went back to the machine, poured me a cup from the flask, and walked back. This was a good-looking woman, about 30, dark, not tall. But to call her medium would be unfair to her. She had a kind of vitality. It had come across as a sympathetic briskness in that first interview room, a professional bustle. Now she seemed unofficial. Probably was. Probably against the fat chief's rules to bring coffee to the condemned man. It made me like her. She passed the cup in through the bars. Up close, she looked good. Smelled good. I didn't recall that from earlier. I remembered thinking of her like a dentist's nurse. If dentist's nurses all looked that good, I'd have gone more often. I took the cup. I was glad of it. I was thirsty and I love coffee. Give me the chance and I drink coffee like an alcoholic drinks vodka. I took a sip. Good coffee. I raised the styrofoam cup like a toast. "Thank you," I said.
"You're welcome,"
she said, and she smiled. With her eyes, too. I smiled back. Her eyes were like a welcome blast of sunshine on a rotten afternoon. "So, you think I didn't do it?" I asked her. She picked up her own cup from where she'd put it down.
"You think I don't bring coffee to the guilty ones?"
she said. "Maybe you don't even talk to the guilty ones," I said.
"I know you're not guilty of much," she said.
"How can you tell?" I said. "Because my eyes aren't too close together?"
"No, fool," she laughed. "Because we haven't heard from Washington yet."
Her laugh was great. I wanted to look at her nameplate over her shirt pocket, but I didn't want her to think I was looking at her breasts. I remembered them resting on the edge of the table when she took my photograph. I looked. Nice breasts. Her name was Roscoe. She glanced around quickly and moved closer to the bars. I sipped coffee.
"I sent your prints to Washington over the computer link," she said. "That was at 12:36. Big database there, you know, FBI. Millions of prints in their computer. Prints that get sent in, I checked. That's a priority order. You get checked, first of all, against the top 10 wanted list, then the top 100, then the top 1,000, you understand? If you'd been near the top, you know, active and unsolved, we'd have heard almost right away. It's automatic. They don't want any big fugitive to slip away, so the system gets right back. But you've been in there almost 3 hours, and we haven't heard, so I can tell you're not on record for anything very bad."
The desk sergeant was looking over, disapproving. She was going to have to go. I drained the coffee and handed her the cup back through the bars. "I'm not on record for anything at all," I said.
"No," she said. "You don't match the deviant's profile."
"I don't," I said.
"I could tell right away," she smiled. "You got nice eyes."
She winked and walked away, trashed the cups and moved over to her workstation. She sat down. All I could see was the back of her head. I moved into my corner and leaned up against the hard bars. I'd been a lonely wanderer for 6 months. I'd learned something. Like Blanche in that old movie, a wanderer depends on the kindness of strangers. Not for anything specific or material, for morale. I gazed at the back of Roscoe's head and smiled. I liked her. Baker had been gone maybe 20 minutes, long enough to get back from Hubble's place, wherever it was. I figured you could walk there and back in 20 minutes. This was a small town, right? A dot on the map. I figured you could walk anywhere and back in 20 minutes. On your hands. Although the town limits were pretty weird. Depended whether Hubble lived in town or somewhere else within the outer boundaries. According to my experience, you were in town even when you were 14 miles away. If that 14 miles extended in all directions,
Then Margrave was about as big as New York City. Baker had said Hubble was a family man, a banker who worked in Atlanta. That meant a family house somewhere near town, near schools and friends for the kids, near shops and the country club for the wife. An easy drive for him up the county road to the highway. Convenient commute up the highway to the office in the big city. The address sounded like a town address. 25 Beckman Drive. Not too close to Main Street. Probably Beckman Drive ran from the center of town out into the countryside. Hubble was a financial guy. Probably rich. Probably had a big white place on a big lot. Shade trees, maybe a pool. Call it 4 acres. A square lot covering 4 acres was about 140 yards on a side. Homes on the left and the right of the street put number 25 about 12 lots out from town. About a mile, maybe. Outside the big plate glass doors, the sun was falling away into afternoon. The light was redder, shadows were longer. I saw Baker's patrol car yaw and bounce into the driveway. No flashing lights. It came slowly around the semicircle and eased to a stop, bounced once on its springs. Its length filled the view through the plate glass. Baker got out on the far side and walked out of sight as he rounded the car. He reappeared as he approached his passenger's door. He opened it like a chauffeur. He looked all twisted up with conflicting body language. Part deferential, because this was an Atlanta banker, part friendly, because this was his partner's bowling buddy, part official, because this was a man whose phone number had been hidden in a corpse's shoe. Paul Hubble got out of the car. Baker shut the door. Hubble waited. Baker skipped around him and pulled open the big plate glass door of the station house. It sucked against the rubber seal. Hubble stepped inside. He was a tall, white man. He looked like a page from a magazine, an advertisement, the sort that uses a grainy photograph of money at play. He was in his early 30s, trim but not strong. Sandy hair, tousled, receding just enough to show an intelligent brow, just enough to say, yes, I was a preppy, but hey, I'm a man now. He wore gold-rimmed, round eyeglasses. He had a square jaw, a decent tan, very white teeth. Many of them were on show as he smiled at the desk sergeant. He wore a faded polo shirt with a small logo and washed chino pants, the sort of clothes that look old when you buy them for $500. He had a thick white sweater draped over his back. The arms were loosely tied in front. I couldn't see his feet because the reception desk was in the way. I was certain he would be wearing tan boat shoes. I made a substantial bet with myself he was wearing them without socks. This was a man who wallowed in the yuppie dream like a pig in shit. He was in a state of some agitation. He placed his palms on the reception desk and then turned and dropped his hands to his sides. I saw sandy forearms and the flash of a heavy gold watch. I could see his natural approach would be to act like a friendly rich guy, visiting the station house like our campaigning president would visit a factory. But he was distracted, uptight. I didn't know what Baker had said to him, how much he had revealed. Probably nothing. A good sergeant like Baker would leave the bombshells to Finley. So Hubble didn't know why he was here. But he knew something. I was a policeman of sorts for 13 years, and I can smell a worried man a mile away. Hubble was a worried man. I stayed leaning up on the bars, motionless. Baker signaled Hubble to walk with him around the far side of the squad room, toward the Rosewood office in back. As Hubble rounded the end of the reception desk, I saw his feet. Tan boat shoes, no socks. The two men walked out of sight into the office. The door closed. The desk sergeant left his post and went outside to park Baker's cruiser. He came back in with Finley at his side. Finley walked straight back toward the Rosewood office where Hubble waited for him, ignored me as he crossed the squad room, opened the office door and went inside. I waited in my corner for Baker to come out. Baker couldn't stay in there. Not while his partner's bowling buddy entered the orbit of a homicide investigation. That would not be ethical. Not ethical at all. Finley struck me as a guy who would go big on ethics. Any guy with a tweed suit like that and a moleskin vest and a Harvard education would go big on ethics. After a moment, the door opened and Baker came out. He walked into the big open room and headed for his desk. "Hey, Baker," I called. He changed course and walked over to the cells, stood in front of the bars where Roscoe had stood. "I need to go to the bathroom," I said. "Unless I gotta wait until I get up to the big house for that, too." He cracked a grin. Grudging, but a grin. He had a gold tooth way back. Gave him a rakish air, a bit more human. He shouted something to the desk guy. Probably a code for a procedure. He took out his keys and activated the electric lock. The bolts popped back. I wondered briefly how they did it if there was a power outage. Could they unlock these gates without electricity? I hoped so. Probably lots of thunderstorms down here. Lots of power lines crashing down. He pushed the heavy gate inward. We walked to the back of the squad room, opposite corner to the Rosewood office. There was a lobby. Off the lobby were two bathrooms. He reached past me and pushed open the men's room door. They knew I wasn't their guy. They weren't taking care, no care at all. Out there in the lobby, I could have decked Baker and taken his revolver, no problem at all. I could have had his weapon off his belt before he hit the floor. I could have shot my way out of the station house and into a patrol car. They were all parked right out front, keys in for sure. I could have got out toward Atlanta before they organized effective opposition. Then I could have disappeared. No problem at all. But I just went into the bathroom. "Don't lock it," Baker said. I didn't lock it. They were underestimating me in a big way. I had told them I had been a military policeman. Maybe they believed me, maybe they didn't. Maybe it didn't mean much to them either way. But it should. A military policeman deals with military lawbreakers. Those lawbreakers are service guys, highly trained in weapons, sabotage, unarmed combat. Rangers, Green Berets, Marines. Not just killers, trained killers. Extremely well-trained at huge public expense. So the military policeman is trained even better. Better with weapons, better unarmed. Baker had to be ignorant of all that. Hadn't thought about it. Otherwise, he would have had a couple of shotguns aimed at me for the trip to the bathroom. If he thought I was their guy. I zipped up and came back into the lobby. Baker was waiting. We walked back to the cell area. I stepped inside my cell, leaned up in my corner. Baker pulled the heavy gate shut, operated the electric lock with his key. The bolts snicked in. He walked away into the squad room. There was silence for the next 20 minutes. Baker worked at a desk. So did Roscoe. The desk sergeant sat up on his stool. Finley was in the big office with Hubble. There was a modern clock over the front doors. Not as elegant as the antique in the office, but it ticked around just as slowly. Silence. 4:30. I leaned up against the titanium bars and waited. Silence. 4:45. Time restarted just before 5 o'clock. I heard a commotion coming out of the big Rosewood office and back. Shouting, yelling, things banging, somebody getting really stirred up. A buzzer sounded on Baker's desk and the intercom crackled. I heard Finley's voice, stressed, asking Baker to get in there. Baker got up and walked over, knocked and went in. The big plate glass door at the entrance sucked open, and the fat guy came in, Chief Morrison. He headed straight back to the Rosewood office. Baker came out as Morrison went in. Baker hurried over to the reception desk, whispered a long, excited sentence to the desk sergeant. Roscoe joined them. There was a huddle. Some big news. I couldn't hear what. Too far away. The intercom on Baker's desk crackled again. He headed back to the office. The big front door opened again. The afternoon sun was blazing low in the sky. Stevenson walked into the station house. First time I'd seen him since my arrest. It was like the excitement was sucking people in. Stevenson spoke to the desk sergeant. He became agitated. The desk sergeant put a hand on Stevenson's arm. Stevenson shook it off and ran toward the Rosewood office. He dodged desks like a football player. As he got to the office door, it opened. A crowd came out. Chief Morrison, Finley, and Baker, holding Hubble by the elbow. A light but efficient grip, the same as he'd used on me. Stevenson stared blankly at Hubble and then grabbed Finley by the arm, pulled him back into the office. Morrison swiveled his sweating bulk and followed them in. The doors slammed. Baker walked Hubble over toward me. Hubble looked like a different guy. He was gray and sweating. The tan had gone. He looked smaller. He looked like someone had let the air out and deflated him. He was bent up like a man racked with pain. His eyes behind the gold rims were blank and staring with panic and fear. He stood shaking as Baker unlocked the cell next to mine. He didn't move. He was trembling. Baker caught his arm and levered him inside. He pulled the gate shut and locked it. The electric bolts snicked in. Baker walked back toward the Rosewood office.